But you can still say that, you know, a large amount of communication is done non-verbally. And if you're missing that, you're missing so much of what's really going on.
Welcome to Your Intended Message, the perfect place for leaders and promising professionals who want to convey the intended message for greater success. Every week, we interview experts who address the challenges and best practices to deliver your message effectively. That might be one-to-one, one-to-few, or one-to-many. And perhaps the most important conversation, one-to-self. I'm your host, George Torok.
My guest today is Richard Newman. Here's three facts that I think you should know about Richard. One, for 6 months, Richard lived in the foothills of the Himalayas in a Tibetan monastery with monks who didn't speak English. Richard was teaching them how to speak English. Two, Richard's team coached one client to win over, wait for it, $1 billion in new business within a year by winning 100% of their new business pitches. That's news. And three, Richard lives near London, England, with his wife of 20 years and two sons. Richard Newman, welcome to Your Intended Message.
Thanks, George. Appreciate it. And thanks for having me on Your Intended Message.
Delighted to be talking with you today. And in particular, we'd like to explore the concept of body language, which there's a lot of myths about it, and there's a lot of people who pretend to be gurus and based on just a couple points. But you, I believe your interest in body language and messaging started from your time with the monks.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, actually, before I was even with the monks, I've been fascinated with this area of nonverbal communication. If I go all the way back to when I was 4 going on to 5 years old, what happened for me is that I moved to school. I went from one area to the next as my parents moved house. And I found myself in a situation where I was trying to make friends with the kids at the school. And I was really struggling to connect with them, really struggling to communicate. I felt as though I was living in this kind of glass bubble, unable to connect with these people around me. And I didn't really understand why. And it took 4 decades for me to figure it out, which is that I always knew I was intensely shy. I learned through the years that I'm highly introverted, but it was only when I was 45 that I was diagnosed autistic. And so I had from a very early age, a different way of seeing communication, a different way of seeing human behavior. So where neurotypical people will, you know, interact a bit like a fish in water, they just sort of swim around and, you know, do everything that needs to be done as if I was on the outside looking in, observing what was happening between these other neurotypical kids, thinking, what am I missing? How do I use the on-ramp to get into this conversation, to interact and so on? And so through my childhood, I then started to really look at this and try to figure out, well, what can I do to improve my communication? And at the age of 16, I got this book on body language by Alan Pease, which is one of the sort of classic works back in the day. We started my fascination in the area, and I then went on to read over 200 books on communication around body language, tone of voice, stage presence, rhetoric, everything around communication. And in the midst of that, I found myself living with these monks. And the big challenge that I found, there I was in the foothills of the Himalayas. I'm just 18 years old at the time. And I was living with these monks who, when I arrived, I discovered didn't speak any English at all. They spoke Nepali, Tibetan, and Hindi. And I spoke a bit of French and a bit of German. And so none of our languages could be used to connect with each other. So we had to communicate non-verbally. There was no other way about it. And I learned from them something really powerful that I help people with these days in business, in their personal lives, and so on, and for helping them pitch for $1 billion worth of work and everything in between, is that what I learned from them fundamentally is the power of congruency in how you communicate, in that your body language, your tone of voice, and your words have to go in the same direction for you to really deliver your intended message. And if you find that they're going in different directions, then suddenly there's confusion that takes hold. So for example, when I was with the monks, if I was trying to teach them the word excited, like I was trying to teach them emotions and how to express them, if I was trying to teach them that, if I didn't look excited and I didn't sound excited, they had no idea what I was saying. I could be saying pineapple and they'd have no idea. But the same goes day to day when we're working with business clients. You'll often get, I work at conferences a lot. I'm often booked as a conference speaker. And normally before me, the CEO will walk on the stage, the CFO will walk on the stage, and then maybe they bring up the keynote speaker. So usually before me, there's a CFO talking about the numbers for the year. And what you typically get is they'll walk on stage with a poker face, a very sort of business-like expression. They'll say, hi, everybody. Very excited to be here today. Glad that you made it. The numbers for this month were good. The numbers for this year were bad. And the numbers for next year are going to be better. And people are left thinking, hang on a second. What does this mean? I don't feel anything. I don't understand. The person seems a little bit nervous, a little bit muted. Maybe the whole business is going bankrupt. We don't know. And because the body language, the tone of voice and the words, they're just not connected based on this sort of business facade that people put in. What I'm often working on with people is to help them really find their voice and to drop that facade and to bring their expression to life so they can have that congruent communication that I needed to have when I was working with those monks.
Looking back from your years of experience back at that four-year-old child, what did you see that four-year-old child needed to do differently?
Yeah, so I think for me, it was simply there's this way of interacting, if you like. They've seen this in recent studies that neurotypical people can communicate perfectly well with each other, and autistic people can. They have the same instincts on communication. It's just when they're trying to interact with each other that suddenly there is a disconnect. And, you know, autism is a huge spectrum. It's very broad. And so I can't speak for different people who are autistic. But in my case, it was a mismatch of trying to read the situation, read what people are giving off as a visual non-verbally around their message. So I would take things very literally. A good example of this, something that I learned later in life, somebody once, there was like a group gathering, and a person came over to me. I was speaking to one person and they came over to me and said, "Richard, can you just give us a minute?" Now I thought that meant, okay, you want me to give you a minute of my time, so I should go and spend time with you for the next 60 seconds. That's what I took from it, literally. What they meant is, I want to speak to the other person, not you, so can you leave us alone? But that's not what they said. So I was taking the whole thing literally, and then they were looking at me like, why don't you leave me alone? I just told you to leave me alone. And I'm thinking, no, you told me to give you a minute, and now you're upset with me, even though I'm generously giving you my time? And so that's what I was doing back then. I was just sort of taking things literally and not able to read those little non-verbal cues that were going on around me, which is where I became so fascinated with the body language side of things. And, you know, there's lots of statistics out there and there's a lot of misconceptions. Like people say, you know, 93% of communication is nonverbal, which, you know, that's based on a study that was done by Albert Mehrabian back in the 1960s with a small handful of people in California. And he himself went on BBC Radio about 10 years ago saying that those statistics were blown way out of proportion and people have taken them to mean things they never were meant to say. But you can still say that, you know, a large amount of communication is done nonverbally. And if you're missing that, you're missing so much of what's really going on. In fact, I take this into activities I do with some of my clients where I'll get them to read a script. They just get the words, which is kind of what I was taking on board back in the day. And I say to them, what does this mean? What's happening in this scene? They give me a version. Then I'll play the scene from a movie. And I'll say, okay, now you've got the words and the tone of voice. Tell me what's happening. What's giving you more, the tone of voice or the words? And they always say, the tone of voice is giving me way more than just the words were. And then I'll show them the clip. And I'll say, now you're getting the body language, the tone of voice, and the words. What's happening? Is it what you thought when you just read those words? And they'll say, no, it's nothing to do with what the words said. The words didn't help me at all. It's actually something completely different. And I can only see that based on the body language. To which I then say to people, okay, you've got an important message to deliver this week. If you want to deliver your intended message, are you going to send an email? Are you going to pick up the phone? Or are you going to go and meet the person in face-to-face? And they say face-to-face every single time. But we know that actually what people do is they send important messages through like emails or text, and the vast majority of the message is lost. So that was the piece that was so valuable to me back then. It's just to understand there's so much going on beyond what a person is actually saying. So focusing in on the words is important because it's one ingredient, but it's not the entire picture. And so you've got to read the entire picture of the communication. And that's what I've been pursuing ever since.
And certainly we can put more content into words. We can use words to describe more. So do we use body language as an indicator of emotion or an indicator of truth versus untruth?
Yeah, so I think a palette of emotions is a great way to explain this. And I should say that, you know, I love words. I'm passionate about words. I've written a couple of books. I was very proud to win a speech writing award going back a few years ago. And so, you know, words can be extraordinarily valuable. But then you've got to think about, if you are with people, then your body language and your tone of voice is there as the palette that brings this to life. And so you don't want to just have a gray canvas. You need to express it. You need to express what that message really means. So I often say this to an audience where I say to them, if I was to say to you this message, tell me what it means. This will change our results by 3%. And I say to them, so you tell me, is that good news or bad news? And they go, I don't know. It could be either. I don't know. I need the context. I couldn't tell you. I say to them, tell me if 3% is a big number or a small number. And they say, well, I don't know. That would, again, depend on the situation, depend on how the person delivered it. I don't actually know. And so, you know, even if there's something that is a dry, proven scientific fact, you still need to engage the body language and the tone of voice to let people know how they are designed to feel about this, or how they need to feel about it. And so you've got to remember that when you're engaging with human-to-human behavior, for our communication, there's three key parts of the mind that are really being engaged, or that you need to engage, which is the survival mind, the emotional mind, and the logical mind. And if you're just giving people words, if you're just going based on words, then you're going to be giving people logic and facts. And there could be emotive words in there, but the emotional mind might be, you know, taking it out of context, misreading it in a certain direction. The emotional mind is very powerfully impacted by the body language and the tone of voice, which will then tell people if that 3% is big or small, good or bad, reassuring, exciting, inspirational, or anything in between. And it's that emotional connection that is so critical for us in human relationships, where if you interact with somebody and it feels very transactional, it just feels like it's sort of logic being passed back and forth, then you don't really feel like you've got a connection with them. Whereas if there is emotion being expressed or emotion being shared and you feel empathy from the other person, you feel like you've actually got a connection with them. And so that's what body language and tone of voice can allow you to do. And to go all the way back to the monks again, vividly remember this, sitting in their kitchen, drinking some Tibetan tea and not being able to connect with words at all. And suddenly thinking, how does this work? That I feel like I'm really connected with them and I have an understanding of who they are as people, even though they don't know my words and I don't know theirs. And flash forward to actually just like 4 years ago, I was at a retreat in Italy. Part of this, they were doing like meditation and so on. And at one point they said, for the next 3 hours, you're not allowed to speak. And that includes having lunch with each other. And we're going to tell all the staff making the lunch, they can't speak to you either. And so some people looked horrified. And I thought, oh, thank goodness, this is going to be such a relief because I don't have to make small talk. Small talk's not my bag. And so I was able to sit there then. And we've been at this retreat for maybe 3 or 4 days at this point. And I sat there across the table from people, thankfully not needing to talk. And I just suddenly thought, I now finally see you. I can see who you are as people because the behavior is there representing who you are. I don't need the words. You know, words are useful for us. Of course, they have an incredible value for us, but I don't need them in order to get your essence. And I've often said this to people about, you know, hiring someone. I've had the privilege of hiring dozens of people to work with me over the years. And it's interesting to me how every person who I've hired is exactly who I thought they would be in the first 30 seconds of meeting them. That as they walked into the room, I got a general sense of who they are as a person, how they hold themselves, you know, what they may have done in order to prepare themselves for this interview, how they approach situations. You get a lot in that 30 seconds, which is often, you know, messages you're getting from your subconscious mind, some of which can be useful, some of which may work against you, depends on how strong your mindset is. But every person has always been who I thought they would be in that 30 seconds. It's critical that people get used to the idea of seeing beyond the words, hearing beyond the words, listening to people through the words, the tone, and the body language if you really want to connect.
Richard, are you suggesting that you made these evaluations of people in the first 30 seconds and you found that generally to be true? So does that suggest that our body language can't lie?
Well, I mean, your body language can lie, just to put that one forwards. Some people are very skilled at doing that. So if people are very thoroughly prepared and rehearsed at what they're doing, and they have little guilt or shame about using a lie, then they can absolutely come across highly convincing. So, you know, sometimes people say that the body the body doesn't lie or the body tells the truth and so on. And, you know, providing the person isn't highly prepared and skilled at it, then you're going to get a lot of truth that's coming through. But there's a few different pieces to put around that. So firstly, go back to the example of the CFO speaking at a conference. I've worked with many people, many leaders, to coach them to go on stage to speak because a lot of people find it a terrifying experience. So just imagine that, though. You're watching a CFO walk on stage to do a speech and they look terrified and they say, "Trust me, the numbers are good." Now, what you see is you think this person's terrified. They must be lying to me because the body language and words are going in different directions. Therefore, I need to start looking for another job. But actually, what you're seeing isn't related to the words. It's related to the situation. So it's always important to think, well, hang on a second. What am I seeing here? Can I get a package around this? I think it was Joellen Demetrius who was talking about this in terms of she was looking at a jury selection. So she was always aiming to read people who would be useful in that context. And she was saying you need to look for a cluster of things around someone's body language to really understand what's going on for them and then understand the context of that situation. Because some people will tell you that, for example, scratching your nose means that you're lying or variations around that. And I can tell you that might be part of a cluster, but it's not a way to judge somebody if they are being truthful or not. I've had the great privilege of going and interviewing Paul Ekman, who's one of the greatest living scientists on the field of body language and the expression of human emotion. And he's the person who was behind the TV show Lie to Me, which was with Tim Roth going back a few years, where they took his work basically and they built it around his work there. Again, he would say the same thing. You've got to look at the context of a situation. So he was once working with security guards at an airport to see if he could, you know, figure out who was a threat that was coming through. And so he was watching the monitor and he noticed somebody who looked highly agitated. And so he said to the security guards, "You might want to interview this person." Now, it turned out that the person was highly agitated because they were getting on a flight at last minute because their father had suddenly been ill and died. And they were just feeling highly agitated about going through the airport because of that reason. So you always have to put it around the context of that situation. As another fun one to look at, because sometimes people like to look at the fun side of this, if you're planning to tease somebody, so you're planning not to tell the truth because you just want to, you know, be playful, the best way to do that is to be driving while you're doing it. My wife is great fun. I've been with my wife now 20 years, as I think you mentioned at the beginning. I remember thinking about a situation where I could tease her. And I thought, what I need to do, I'm going to pick her up from work in my car. And then when I'm driving, I need to negotiate various different junctions. That's what I'm going to say it to her, because she won't be able to read my body language because my hands are on the wheel. My eyes are going back and forth from my mirrors and the cars outside. She won't be able to read it. And therefore, I'll be able to play along with this joke far longer than if I was just looking at her sitting face to face. We managed to play it out for a good couple of minutes before I finally revealed, no, I'm teasing you the whole time. So various ways through that in terms of, you know, thinking about your body language. But overall, what I would say to people is to make sure that your body language is delivering the truth. You've got to make sure you get rid of any emotion that might be getting in the way of you delivering your intended message so that you can then make sure your body language, your tone of voice and words do go in one direction so that people get the truth from you from the nonverbal and the verbal side of the communication.
That's an interesting example about you can lie when you're driving. I've heard of people who like to conduct meetings while walking. You know, walking around the block, walking in a park, just because there's fresh air and there's movement. Now, in that situation, it's similar to being in the car because you can't see the person.
Mm.
You're not looking at them. So is that an opportunity to lie?
There's pros and cons of this situation. So, you know, I think a lot of people do this. I heard that Steve Jobs used to do this a lot with his team and with journalists as well. I've enjoyed doing it myself with my team, where I think that it is good to be able to walk side by side and be able to process ideas with each other. It's also a way of just relating, feeling like it's a more of a social conversation. You're getting oxygen flow through the body, which helps you generate ideas. And there's also less pressure than if you're sitting across a desk from someone where ideas can stagnate and you can maybe start to feel aggressive or defensive. So it really depends. If you want to have a conversation with someone that's important, but without putting pressure on them, then a side-by-side conversation, taking a walk, can be a great way to do that, because you're able to deliver the message. They can really hear your tone of voice. They can turn and look at you as you're saying things, but it doesn't feel like there's as much pressure as if they were sitting across a table from you. And in other situations like that, you know, sometimes it's best not to sit across a table at all, sitting around the corner of a table. So it just feels more like we're having a discussion, we're working together, can be a much better way to do things. So there's a sense of collaboration. So I think walks can be useful at certain moments.
And that's interesting. And yes, sitting across a table from someone is probably not a good idea if it's a critical topic where there's going to be conflict, because you look like I'm ready to fight. Yeah, you can't say that to me. I'll show you.
Yeah, it can bring up that sense. And so this is something that I learned back from very early days, where when I was starting my business, I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't have a degree. I didn't go to business school and so on. And I just had this idea, this passion for helping people find their voice. And to do that, I had to start going to networking events. I didn't know how to go to a networking event. I didn't even know what they were. I didn't know what the word meant. And so I started going to them. And then I noticed very quickly that if I walked up and I stood face to face with somebody, and I was thinking, well, I'm doing the right thing by giving them my full attention, the person would very quickly start to feel a bit awkward, like I'd almost trapped them in this conversation. There was no way for them to escape. So I learned very quickly, and it's in a lot of books and good research as well, is that if you're slightly angled as you're speaking to the person, then it says, you know, there's no pressure on them. They can leave at any time. And also somebody else can come and join your conversation if required. So that's an interesting way to look at things. There's also part of that. You can start to read from the person if you're in that situation, if they're engaged with you or not. Because if their feet are turned towards you or generally inwards towards the conversation, then you know that they're engaged with you. If their feet are headed towards the door or away from you, and that just their head is turned back towards you, then it's a sense of, I really want to leave now. I want to go and speak to somebody else. So picking up on these cues early on was invaluable for me, because I could think, okay, their words are saying, I'm really enjoying this conversation with you, Richard. I want to be here. If their feet were pointing towards the door or towards someone else, I'd think, I need to make it easy for this person just to move away from the conversation if they want to, and just let them know that that's all right. So in my body language and my words, set them up for that so they feel comfortable around me. Yeah, it's worthwhile paying attention to those little cues in those situations.
So I'm hearing that it is possible to notice these cues and small nuances and correct them so that we can look better.
Yeah, absolutely. With your body language, it's one of those things that sometimes people say, oh, actually, I heard a person say a while back, you can't teach communication. You can either do it or you can't. And I had to ease him into then my training session, because he was sitting at the back of a room, not realizing I was near the back of the room preparing to go up and teach communication. And so I said, look, you can have a fixed mindset on this, or you can have a growth mindset around this. And, you know, gave a bit of my story. And I said, I came from a background, I was terrified to stand up and speak in class, because I just, you know, didn't have any confidence around communication. And now I was on stage teaching in front of thousands of people and enjoying it, not just teaching, but teaching communication. And so it's one of those things that you can learn. And if you think about it a little bit like this, you know, it's worthwhile learning lessons where if you approach tennis the same way as body language, if you think, well, you're just a natural or you're not, then imagine, you know, any of the great tennis players who's doing well at the moment, like Novak Djokovic, let's say. If you imagine when he was 5 years old, his parents said to him, oh, there's a tennis court over there. Just go and be yourself. Just be natural. He'd be a terrible player. He wouldn't have any idea how to play the game. He wouldn't be a champion. But instead, what happened is he had lessons around forehand, backhand, serve, volley, and everything else around the game. And then he built that up in his own way, his own method, his own style. So he has his own personality on the court. The same goes with body language, is that you can start to learn what the principles are. And the important thing around that is that you make them your own, just like with playing tennis. You make them into your own style, your own personality. There are certain things that everybody can use, that everybody can learn, that you can apply universally, that will get you the same results every time. And that's what we found in my research project on this, which people can look up online. It's called Nonverbal Influence. We worked on this with UCL, University College of London with Professor Adrian Fernham, who's one of the top psychologists in the world today. He's published around 1,000 different papers, I think, on communication psychology and so on. And we put together a project, took 18 months to do, but I was determined to prove, is there something that we can all do physically that will change the impact of our words? So you keep the words the same, you wear the same clothes, but you just slightly change your body language. And would that give you a better rating in terms of how confident, how charismatic you are seen to be, how convincing you are, how good a leader you are? Is there anything that's in there that's universal? And what we proved through our study is that it didn't matter what your skin color was, it didn't matter what your gender was, and it didn't matter where we tested this in the world. We tested around Europe, Asia, and the Americas, that there were certain traits that you could use, that if you used them, suddenly that one of the biggest increases we got was that if you changed, I think it was 2 or 3 aspects of your communication, that you could then increase the number of people who would vote for you in an election by nearly 58%, just based on changing a couple of pieces. You can increase the number of people who think you're a good leader by 44%, just by changing a couple of small pieces that everybody can use, everyone can learn. One of the people involved in our study that we did this, I'd never come across any of these techniques before. And in the space of just a couple of hours of working with him on this and filming the videos ready for our study, he was able to embody all of those techniques. So these are things that everybody can do.
You mentioned Djokovic, the tennis player. Obviously, I'm sure he practices even now. Are there exercises that you practice from time to time or review around body language?
From my perspective, I thoroughly enjoy speaking on stage, and I see stage craft really as a craft, as a skill that needs to be worked on, because you're taking an audience on an emotional flight path from the beginning to the end of the experience. And so there'll be aspects of that that I want to review and work on. And so one of the pieces that I continuously look at and work on is around the past, present, and future use of body language. And this is something that we love training to so many people. Salespeople love this piece, is that if you're looking at a stage, make it simpler. If people are looking at a screen and someone is showing them a graph where January is on one side of the screen and December is on the other, we all immediately know that January will be on the left of the screen and December will be on the right of the screen. We see time going from past on the left to the future is on the right. That's the way that we see it. And so I use that in my stagecraft, practicing as I tell a story, where do I need to be on the stage in order to make sure that the visual journey I'm creating as the storyteller is going in the right direction. So I can start off by talking about the past of something and then skip forward in time to the future. And then I can come back and talk about something that's in the past, then come back to present day. And so I can use the stage around these pieces. So whenever I create a new story, a new activity I'm doing, I'm thinking about, well, where on the stage do I need to be in order to deliver this part, in order to make it work for the audience? So I love that part of it. I also love thinking about, what is the feeling I need to deliver by the end of this story? And therefore, what part of my body language or tone can I engage? You know, what sort of gesture? Do I need to be coming in with a very strong palms down gesture partway through to really land a serious point? Or should it be more of a questioning gesture where I'm opening up to the audience and making sure that I'm, you know, showing that I'm engaging them and getting their opinions on board? And so I always love looking at it that way, thinking, what is the feeling they need to have by the end of this story, by the end of this entire speech? What is that flight path like? And what do I do along the way that's going to make that happen?
Words, tone, body language, together they deliver a full message, a whole message, and they contribute differently. Am I hearing that most, although the words might be the content, the data, the tone in the body language is more likely to influence the emotion?
That's exactly what I would say. If people are watching somebody deliver a message, then that's absolutely going to be the case. From my experience of working with people, and you know, put it in context, I've trained 120,000 people around the world, and I'm continuously asking them this question and looking into the research behind it. There isn't as well-known a study or a high-quality study that I can point to that says this is the definitive amount that it is. But whenever I'm asking an audience and I split up the parts of the communication and ask them, which one are you genuinely getting more from? Then body language and tone of voice. That's not to say that you can't feel emotion from words because, you know, as an author myself, and I read books to my kids, there's so much emotion that you can get off the page from reading something. And sometimes reading a book can be more powerful than watching the movie where you go, they didn't do it as well as I did it in my head when I was reading this book. So when you've just got the text, you can certainly get huge amounts of emotion, imagination happening. When you've got the text, plus the tone of voice, plus the body language, we are taking in so much. We are visual beings. The optic nerve is the largest nerve anywhere in the human body. And technically, it's not even a nerve. It's an extension of the brain stem. And so you're getting so much information coming in visually that it's overriding, if you like, the value of the words to the point where you think the visual stuff is so important. So you've got to make sure that if you are delivering a message face-to-face, you think about the visual delivery of it and not just the placement of the correct words in the sentence.
Your latest book is called Lift Your Impact. Who is that for and what will they gain from that?
So I wrote this book, Lift Your Impact, based on the challenges people have had over the last few years, which have really shifted, actually. So I wrote a book a few years back called You Were Born to Speak that was more focused on the communication side when people were looking more for like public speaking training. And what I noticed during the pandemic is three major challenges that came up for people where people have found that they are feeling more stressed recently, they got overwhelmed by all sorts of different demands on their time. People are feeling more lonely because they've had less connection with other human beings, lots of virtual working. There's less sort of gatherings at coffee breaks and grabbing a drink after work. And so people are feeling isolated, even if they're going into work. And thirdly, people feeling a lack of meaning, a lack of purpose in the work that they're doing. And so I wrote the book to give people three things, which is a really powerful mindset. So you can be a rock in the storm whenever you need to be, no matter what pressures are going on around you. Secondly, to have deeper connection with people, be that through working on your body language, tone of voice, storytelling skills, questioning skills, listening skills, all of those pieces. And then thirdly, to think about how can you transform your future and have a legacy and a life that feels really purposeful and worthwhile. And so it's going into all those areas and written like a workbook. So people can sort of make it their own. They make their notes, they go through it and really process the activities. So I feel really proud of it.
Sounds like a guide to moving our lives forward in a more positive direction with all the abuse we've suffered through the pandemic.
Yeah, that's certainly my intention for people. Yeah.
As we prepare to wrap up, if you could have a conversation with that CFO or CEO at the corporate event long before they get on stage, and you could give them one, two, or three pieces of advice to get their body language more in sync with their intended message, what might be that advice you'd give them?
The first advice, to come back to something I've mentioned, is for them to think about a week after the conference or a month after the conference, what is the feeling that they want people to have about what the CFO delivered? How do they want them to feel? What do they want them to remember about it? And everything in the delivery needs to focus towards that. If you want people to feel uplifted and inspired and excited, it's going to be very different body language than if you want them to feel concerned or disappointed. So everything has to head in that direction. A second piece that I would put into there is that being a leader within a company means that you need to also attach, no matter what emotion you're going for, you need to think about the gravitas in your delivery. So it's taken as being important. And gravitas comes from aligning your body with gravity. There's so many people who deliver messages where they are leaning onto one hip, leaning off to one side, or they've crossed their legs across when they're standing up as well. All of which means the very simple way to look at it is if someone was to put one hand on your shoulder and just push you over, would you fall down? If so, you look like a pushover. That's where that phrase or that term comes from. So you want to stand or sit in a way that gravity is working with your body, so that you are embodying that sense of gravitas. Just like a great sports person, before they're about to take an important shot, they get themselves grounded. They have gravity on their side. And the third piece that I get them to do just before they go on the stage is to work on their breathing, much like I went through acting training back in the day. And they get you to work on your breathing to change your state. So you can work on your breathing to make yourself cry or laugh on cue. But for a CFO going on stage, they need to be deeply centered. And so you can do box breathing or square breathing, something like that, to get yourself back to a place where you are fully in charge of your state. And therefore you are this blank canvas ready to deliver a message rather than carrying the weight of, you know, the thousand different tasks a CFO has to do onto the stage. You want to ground yourself, put those things to one side, be ready, and then deliver how you want people to feel.
Powerful advice for any speaker, especially those CFOs and CEOs. My guest today is Richard Newman, reminding you that your message is composed of the words, the tone, and the body language, and they need to be in sync. They need to be congruent.
If you like what you heard, tell your friends and post your 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, because that helps more listeners find us. Come back every week for more practical insights to help you deliver your intended message. I'm your host, George Torok.